It's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
But the Krell forgot one thing, it's monsters, John. Monsters from the id.
There you go again, always blaming me for everything.
Go switch off!
Exterminate!
It's a trap!
This looks extraordinarily bad.
Commencing countdown. T minus 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
There's something strange in your neighborhood. Who are you gonna call?
Guys Busters!
See, I told you there was gonna be a dance number.
So, anyway, that's our tagline this time, because Jen came up with this. We have with us today Philippa Ballantyne, author of Geist Inspector. Welcome to the show.
That's awesome. I wasn't expecting that.
We're thinking of doing a whole video with the dance number and everything. So,
That would be awesome.
That.
I can see that. Just wear cloaks. Just make sure you're wearing cloaks.
Sorry. Anyway, I'm done laughing about myself.
So welcome to the show.
Ah, lovely to be here.
So let's start off right off the bat with the big intro question, which is, mm-hmm. Tell us a little bit about yourself, and why did you come to fantasy and not, like, mad hot romance or something?
Well, I could be doing mad hot romance.
Yeah. But
not. Well, I'm from Wellington in New Zealand, which is indeed where Peter Jackson hangs out and makes fun movies about hobbits with hairy feet. And I've been writing since I was sort of a teenager. I had a bit of a break in the middle where I thought reality, you know, is I'm not going to get published. And then I got over myself and I started writing again. And I've been podcasting as an author since the beginning of 2006. And I've got quite a few books out, especially this year. I've had 3 books out since October. Two with Ace Books and one with HarperCollins, which I co-wrote with T. Morris. And I do all sorts of different fantasy, historical fantasy, epic fantasy, steampunk, that sort of stuff. And I guess why fantasy? Because I just love the sheer scope of it. I like other genres. I'm a big historical genre reader. But as far as writing it, I just like the sheer scope of what you can do. You can do anything with fantasy, you know, mess with history, and go to crazy magical worlds, you know, go to planets distant, all sorts of things. And I think that as a genre can't be beaten.
Definitely. I'm going to skip to the end of, we have a list of questions, believe it or not. Mm-hmm. But I'm going to skip to the very last one because you just touched on that. Geist and Spectre definitely have lots of elements of other genres. You've got mm-hmm. the probability matrix, dirigibles, time travel, teleportation, murder mysteries, and alternate dimensions. Do you consider yourself a genre bender, or do you think that's all kind of part and parcel of fantasy?
I think these days, you know, when I first started reading fantasy, it was very, you know, blinkered as far as what the different subgenres were. And I think people these days are getting quite a kick out of blending things together. And I like the fact that there aren't any rules. You missed one, though. Geist is also a buddy cop movie.
Thank you.
I think it's sort of Starsky and Hutch with magic runes.
Yeah, there is that in there, too. I hadn't thought about that one.
Yeah, I just think I think it's fun. I like to throw a lot of different things in there. Somebody, when they were reviewing Geist, said it was actually reviewed by an urban fantasy book blog, and they said, you know what? People who like epic fantasy might also like this. And I was like, I think, you know, these days people are a lot more sophisticated than they used to be, and they like a bit of romance in their fantasy, and then they don't like freak out about it. Or maybe some people do, but I, you know, I don't think the majority of people worry about it. I think they like having a bit of, you know, a touch of steampunk, a touch of romance, a touch of a Starsky and Hutch moment.
Yeah, well, actually, something you were, when you were saying about that urban fantasy review, it actually made me think, when I was reading Geist, I didn't read it as an urban fantasy.
Mm-hmm.
And that was kind of blew my mind, like, wait, so they're talking about it as an urban fantasy. I was like, I just thought it was just an epic fantasy.
Yeah. Well, the editor at Ace, Danielle Stockley, said, she said it's an epic fantasy, but it's got the tone and the approach of an urban fantasy. If you get what I mean. I don't know.
Oh, I totally get what you mean. He didn't read enough of the books, I don't think, to get that far. One of my questions was actually about, and now that you've said that it's kind of, you know, towards that urban fantasy, but you can almost, to be honest, tell from the cover, at least the American cover, mm-hmm. of the books. I mean, the very prominently displayed female usually helps, although she has more clothing.
Yes, and she has no back tat.
And no back tat.
And she has her whole head. It was always very important that a woman on a cover should have a whole head, as far as I'm concerned.
Well, yeah. And there's a lion instead of, you know, like a vampire or a werewolf or a dog.
That's true. There's nothing that says high fantasy like a lion.
Yeah, well,
oh,
and
yeah.
It does.
It's Narnia, right?
Precisely.
Totally ruined my joke. Thanks a lot, Jen. I was going to say, it's really nice to know that Aslan is still getting work.
He is, yeah. The funny thing was, when the second book, Spectre, came out, I said, you know, are we going to put any of the other characters on the front? And they were like, yeah, we'll do that in book 3 and 4. But, you know, marketing says that cats sell books, so.
Cats sell books.
Cats sell books.
Yeah. There was a Kitty Goes to New York or something, one of those. I forget the author right now. Where it had a big cat on the front, so I guess. And it seemed to do well.
Mm. Well, were creatures are still pretty big, apparently. So
yeah, that's a very good point. So, I mean, that's actually what I was kind of leading towards, though. Well, not the were thing, but Sorsha is definitely not your typical sword and sorcery fantasy heroine. I mean, in the sense that this is, in some ways, just a fantasy, but in so many other ways is not. But, you know, she smokes, she drinks, she swears, she cheats on her husband, she, you know, she's a very modern feminist in the urban fantasy sense, mm-hmm. except that I think a lot of those women tend to be a little weak in some ways. But anyway, that's my own criticism mm-hmm. of urban fantasy. But did you see this type of characterization in fantasy, a more traditional fantasy, as a risk in terms of the marketability and potential popularity of the book?
I mean, I think I was a bit worried that she would, I mean, I think of Sorsha as she's the typical woman that you'd sometimes see in fantasy who's like 20 years old, they've just discovered they're powerful, and she's like 15, 20 years down the track, and she's become a bit arrogant, and she's kind of abrasive and stuff, because let's face it, if you're really powerful and no one's there to stop you, you're going to get arrogant. I mean, just look at, you know, professional sports players. Generally speaking, they get arrogant. And T and I were talking about this today, and he was like, you know, Sorsha, she's like the quarterback who mainly stopped her, and she's, you know, cranky. cranky and full of herself, pretty much. Also, I think I wanted to write a sort of an older character, because you don't see that so much in fantasy. And I wanted to give her like real life problems that real people have. I mean, she's got a deteriorating marriage, and she's not exactly happy in her work and all of that sort of stuff. So I tried to make her a bit more realistic. But through the course of the books, she gets the edges knocked off her, and she kind of realizes that she's not all powerful and she doesn't know everything.
Oh, for sure.
It's just taken her a longer time to realize that. Most people work that out in their 20s. She's coming to her late 30s, and yeah, working that one out.
Yeah, I mean, that's kind of one of the interesting things about her is that because she is a little bit, you know, I wouldn't say advanced in years, but, you know, she's like my age or something. And she's definitely a little bit worn down by the time you get to her and pissed off in general. And which I totally got.
Actually, there's somebody reviewed the book actually today, and they said they loved Saoirse, but sometimes she did stupid things, and they realized that she was actually socially stupid.
Yes. Oh, for sure. I mean, and I actually, one of my initial, I wouldn't even say complaints, but things that I struggled with while reading the first book was that she, you know, is throwing this marriage out that she's had for what, 10 years. And I'm going, my God, you know, I was like, you don't see that in genre very often at all. It more typically in, you know, this so-called literary stuff, you have deteriorating marriages and whatnot, but definitely not in fantasy with that whole, the realism of situations.
Yeah. You see that in fantasy books where they say, you know, they're 20-year-olds and they meet each other and they fall in love and it's all wonderful. And then if you come back in the sequels, it's 15 years later and their relationship hasn't changed at all. They're still madly in love and everything's great. You never see anything, any cracks or any problems that they have. And I was like, you know what? I'd like a little dose of reality in my fantasy, just, you know, mix it up.
It was nice. It was very refreshing, I have to admit, as somebody who's been married for 10 years. 11, actually.
Right.
But we've been kind of, we skipped a whole bunch of questions. So actually, we just skipped
let's go.
One, which was just tell us about Geist Inspector in general.
Well, it's set in a world in which the supernatural is just a given. That was one of the sort of founding ideas that I had was, you know, you see the Ghost Hunters programs where everyone's like, ooh, is that a sound? Well, in this world, it's just a fact that a geist can come through, possess your grandmother, make her head spin around and make her puke everywhere. It's just a fact that that can happen. And the deacons of the order used to be a religious order, isn't anymore. They use runes, which they train very long and hard to learn how to wield. And they're in a partnerships. There are sets of two. There's a sensitive who sort of sees things, directs his partner, and there's the active who actually wields the runes and has the big fireballs and all that sort of stuff. And Saoirse ends up with a new rookie partner, and they end up going to investigate a little town where some sort of geist activity has sort of bubbled up. And it turns out to be so much more than that. Dum, dum, dum. and in Inspector, they end up going to a sort of an exotic part of their empire and discovering there's more. Dum, dum, dum.
I like the addition of the dum, dum, dum.
Dum, dum, dums, yes.
Yes. I mean, it's...
it adds so much more to it. And I actually, yesterday, I just handed in the first rough draft of Wraith, which is going to be the third book, which will be out next year, hopefully. And that one, everything just goes. I was, when I was reading it, I was like, man, there's a lot of stuff flying around in this book. So, and after that, there'll be a fourth book called Harbinger. And
wow.
Yeah. So there's going to be four books in total. Unless, of course, they're wildly popular and they say, give us another, you know, half a dozen, which I'll think about it.
Yeah, it could go on forever. Don't do it forever. I'm just
no
saying.
I think, I mean, I've noticed this when I read other people's books. I think to me the outermost edge of a good concept is 8 books. After that it starts to get, you know, you're just kind of mining for, you know, money and actually enjoying the concept. It's just my personal opinion. I think there's a limit to every good idea. And that, I mean, going back to a world is fine, but keeping going back to the characters, I just, you know.
Yeah. Like, well, Stina Light said last when we interviewed her, she was talking about how she got really annoyed with urban fantasies that went on forever because they would drag out the sexual tension between who the person you knew she was going to hook up with for like 15 books. So you'd every book you'd read, it's like, well, they don't hook up in this book. Maybe it'll be the next one. And it's like, no, no. And so maybe that's also a problem, you know, like you have to come up with new stuff if you're going to have series that big.
Yeah. Yeah. I realized that when I was writing the end of Spectre, I was like, man, I keep pulling these people apart. I can't do that too often. So I promise in the third book, there's they actually cohesively stay together for a little while.
Yay!
Yay! But, you know, bad things happen.
Oh, of course. I mean, that's to be expected. That was actually one of the interesting things about what I noticed is that these are almost not sitcom, serialized sort of books. You have definite contained stories within each one. They have a beginning and, you know, middle and a resolution with a more overarching theme. But I personally don't see that in fantasy very often, where that you have a definite conclusion.
Yeah, I think it's a nice way because you get the audience doesn't feel totally like they've been sucked in and they're not getting anything back. But then people also like to see, oh, the overarching. They can see, oh, I can see that this is going somewhere. I don't know where it's going, but it looks like it's got an end point somewhere. And a book should draw together some kind of conclusion. It doesn't have to be the big one, but it has to have some conclusion.
Yeah, I mean, cliffhangers or anything that resembles a cliffhanger at the end of a book can sometimes drive people crazy.
Yeah, it seems a little cheap, maybe, if you just cliffhanger them right at the end. I mean, you don't want to give them all the answers. You want to keep them coming back, but, you know, give them something. Throw them a bone.
I agree. Yeah. And that actually made me think of, like, have you read Karen Miller?
No. I have barely had anything to read in the last year. I'm starving for the chance to read.
Oh, Karen Miller, she's got a bunch of series out, all in the same world. But one of her books, the U.S. edition, is split in half. And so the first book ends on a cliffhanger, which if you realize that they're meant as one book, well, then the way I recommend it now is, well, just read them as though they're one book. Just pretend that they're not separate texts, because otherwise you'll get to the end and you'll be like, what the heck? This is a total... Like, it just stops right in the middle of the action.
Oh, ouch. Yeah. Yeah, people get annoyed if that sort of thing happens and they don't know.
Yeah.
With Geist and Spectre, you can almost, I mean, you can't completely, but to an extent, you can almost read them separately as you know, you could theoretically start with Spectre and move forward, although I don't completely recommend it. because there's a lot that goes on in the first book that comes back in the second one. But because they're, you know, kind of nicely contained stories on their own, you know, they can be taken that way. And they're fun. I mean, they're fun reads on their own. You just have more depth by putting them together. So
yeah, you get more out of if you've read Geist first. So.
Oh, yeah, for sure. The overarching stuff, which, you know, I'm sure is leading somewhere very interesting.
I hope so.
So do I. Is it leading somewhere interesting? Do you know?
I think it is. What can I hint at?
Don't hint. Don't. Shh.
There are many, many things are going to change. Many things. I think some things that people think are concrete may not be in the third book.
Oh. Okay. Now I'm just going to die between now and next year. So. Okay. So let's get back to the book itself. Geist and Spectre more so in some ways is fairly loaded with religious imagery, particularly in terms of how you've structured the deacons and everything. Did you draw a lot from real world religions to craft the sensitive and actives, or, you know, did you just kind of pull it out of your butt?
Well, I knew that I wanted the order to be based originally on a religious order, with, you know, the hierarchy and how they operate and what their day-to-day sort of lives are, apart from fighting geists, of course. You find out in Spectre, and it's not a spoiler at all, that when the geists actually came through into the world, people kind of threw themselves down on their knees and started praying to gods, you know, save us, and nothing happened. And a lot of people actually ended up turning away from religion. And in their world, religious people are actually kind of looked down on because they're like, well, you believe in that, really? really? So there are still religious orders, but the order itself that protects everybody is really just has the structure of a religious order, nothing else. And I guess I pulled that out probably, you know, out of, I was raised in a all girls, not Catholic school, what Americans would call Episcopalian, an Anglican school. And so that's probably where I pulled most of it out of.
That makes sense.
And some out of my butt.
I like how you admit that. That's
yeah, a little good. Bit.
Well, actually, I mean, Jen has another, I know she has another question about some of the religious elements, but a question I do have is, since your text, or since, not text, I'm in academic mode, I should not call it a text. Goodness gracious. What's wrong with me? In Geist, not the text, in Geist, since there is that these people have become fairly atheistic, or that there are, you know, there's structures that are religious, but that things have sort of changed and they don't really believe in a lot of that anymore. Mm-hmm. Do you find that fantasy makes it easier for you to sort of deal with those kinds of themes, or like, is it a kind of a safe zone, or is it a genre that maybe equally suffers from the pitfalls of, because if in other kinds of genres, as soon as you start talking about religion in any mm-hmm. context, whether it's atheism or whatever, there's always going to be an issue. I mean, you just think like Philip Pullman,
yeah,
where his books get like banned every other week. So.
I wish my book would be banned. Oh, that would be awesome.
Your sales would go up 5,000%.
Oh, they would instantaneously. But I just keep telling the Pope, please ban my book, but he's not answering my calls. Yeah. I think with fantasy, you always have that nice. It is a little buffer around it where you can say, well, it's not really our world. You understand? In Spectre, there are sort of questions about how people manipulate religions to their own benefit, and you would be kind of being naive if you didn't think that happened in our world. So I guess it examines the things that I find interesting about religion, but it doesn't really. There isn't a stand about whether gods exist or not. I can say that the gods did not answer the people's prayers when they were sent, but it doesn't necessarily mean there aren't gods. Does that answer the question, sort of?
Yeah. I think so. I think it gets to the meat of it, yeah. Mm-hmm.
In the book, I mean, you're dealing with some pretty pretty difficult subjects. I mean, Duke just asked about, you know, do you think it's easier to talk about them? I mean, you've got slavery and religious zealotry and a touch of, I wouldn't say women's subjugation necessarily, although that is kind of there. Did you always want to write books that explored such difficult issues, or were they more just convenient world-building devices?
I think when you're writing, I mean, it goes back to that whole, I like a touch of reality in my fantasy. And when you think about history and empires, slavery and the subjugation of women in various places and times and at various sort of levels, all did occur. So it I think it actually enriches the reading experience if you've got some of those things there as a backdrop or even as a really important plot point. To me, it's always just about enriching the world. And if you don't face those sort of dark sides of empire, then it makes it all look very happy. For me, I was thinking about the Roman Empire, obviously. And I mean, there were lots of benefits of the Roman Empire to people. They had, you know, roads, safety. I mean, they held down a lot of sort of minor wars in your area. Your village might be likely to be overrun by your neighbor. But then, of course, you know, you could be thrown into slavery and the tax man would come around and take your stuff. So I wanted it to be even-handed in the empire, that there are good things about being in the empire and there are bad things about it.
Oh, for sure. Mm-hmm. Sorry, I have to get back to. I've been really fascinated with Spectre. I just finished the book this afternoon. This is probably why I'm slightly obsessed with it right at this point in time.
I like that. Obsession is good.
and I asked you, you know, that you're kind of combining genres and everything. how much science fiction do you think you actually were putting in here? And was it deliberate references to more science fictional elements?
You mean time travel?
Well, the time travel and kind of the you know, the devices and...
Oh, yes, yeah. Well, I mean, there's always the question in fantasy of magic versus science.
Right.
And I wanted to have I wanted to have my cake and eat it too. the ancient people were more devices, and what Saoirse and her friends are dealing with now is more about magic. I wanted to have a little bit of that as well. Plus, I've been writing steampunk at the moment, and I enjoy the little, you know, making gizmos and stuff and throwing them around. And you also see a lot in fantasy about the ancients being, you know, all mystical and communing with nature. No, I thought, I want my ancients to be different to that. I want them to be, they have it. They know a little bit about magic, but they're also like mad engineers.
Yeah, I mean, to me, it was almost like a reading about Stargate. I mean, it was like a Stargate novel in some ways, you know. It's like you have these gods that aren't quite gods, but, you know, are gods and manipulating things. You know, is it magic? Is it science? We're not really sure. And I found that my perception of the book changed. I was talking to Sean about this before we got you on. I asked him, I was like, do you find you read fantasy differently than you read science fiction? Mm-hmm. And personally, I do. I think I tend to read less into a fantasy novel than I do a science fiction novel, whether it's just because of the science fiction I'm reading or the fantasy I'm reading, I'm not really sure. But mm-hmm. the second that, I mean, when the probability matrix pops up in Geist.
Yeah.
That to me was, it completely shifted how I was reading things and understanding the story. And it kind of, I mean, I went with the, wow, this is one of the first times that I've read a fantasy novel and really questioned if it was magic or if it was just, you know, really advanced science. That's why I mentioned in my question earlier, alternate dimensions. I mean, you could really just go with an alternate dimension explanation for the other side.
That's right. I mean, is the other side really the other side, or is it like another world that just, you know, got
exactly
mixed up?
And the fact that they're touching, you know, I thought it was, it made for a really interesting understanding, I guess is what I'm getting to, of what's going on.
Yeah, I think the reason that I ended up with machines, I was just remembering as you were talking about that. We have this sort of concept of history as being, you know, guys in togas wandering around, but we don't actually know as much of the past as we think we do. I mean, they just, a few years ago, they discovered this cog device, and they were trying to work out what this, first of all, it blew their minds.
Right.
I can't remember the name of it. They found it on a ship. I think
yeah.
it was off the coast of Greece somewhere. And they were like trying to work out for a first of like cogs. What, how, you know, they, to our way of thinking, they didn't have that technology. And so I was like, okay, so, you know, not everything survives in the ground or in the water, you know, wooden things rot away. So, you know, maybe the ancients were tootling around the, you know, Mediterranean on steam powered ships. We don't know.
you're right. We really don't. That's an interesting take on history.
Yeah. Well, that's how sandalpunk was invented.
Sandalpunk.
Yeah, if T hears me say that, he'll scream and run and just... Yeah, there you go.
Sandalpunk. Yeah, yeah. You're going to have to tell me a little bit about this.
Well, it's part of the sort of the steampunk thing. People are constantly sort of trying to put subgenres onto steampunk. And so if you go back in time, say about around the pyramids or something, and you add on technology that didn't exist for them, then you've got sandalpunk or, I don't know, Caesarpunk.
Right. You know, it's steampunk to me in general. I can't even remember the first time I heard of steampunk. It's got to be what, 4 or 5 years ago now.
Yeah.
And I instantly became obsessed with it. I was like, oh my God, steampunk. That's got to be the coolest thing I've ever heard of. And I would sit out and I would, you know, part of the thing, I had my own blog at one point in time. And I would search out steampunky type things and I would post them. And it was kind of at the, towards the beginning when there really at that time weren't a lot of books, steampunk novels. And now it's kind of, obviously it's fairly exploded and has mm-hmm. become this very popular genre. Why do you think that is? What do you think the allure of steampunk is?
Oh, T and I have discussed this many times, in fact, on panels and stuff. To me personally, I think it's because we have our face pressed up against the future and we're a little bit scared about what our role in the future is. So it's almost comforting to look backwards and go, oh, you know, when we were setting out and we didn't know anything about the world and machines were still understandable by, you know, a semi-literate person could look at a steam engine and work out how it worked. Whereas if you crack open an iPad, not so many people are going to be able to work that out. So I think it's a little bit nostalgia. It's cool. Goggles are cool. Airships are cool. And it's manners. People also have a bit of nostalgia for a time when people, you know, were at least on the outside nice to each other. I come to steampunk from a sort of an alternate history kind of path because I used to, well, I wrote a book about Shakespeare and fairies and I really enjoyed messing around with history. And so for me, that's what I like about it. I like going back in time and our books, our Ministry of Peculiar Occurrences books are all messing about with history and getting involved with historical figures. We're just about to start editing the second book of the Ministry of Peculiar Occurrences. And I take a suffragette from New Zealand who's actually on our $10 bill, and I like rip off half her face and put a, you know, a brass replacement with it, like a jaw and a.
Of course.
Like, you know.
That's awesome.
I mean, I just like, it's just fun. I think that's what I like about steampunk is it's just fun. There are people who write dystopian steampunk, and that's really cool. But for me, I just like a good romp.
I was just remembering that the first time that, to me, one of the first occurrences of steampunk, and it's probably not, the first time I ever was introduced to it wasn't even steampunk at all. It was Neal Stephenson's A Diamond Age.
Mm-hmm.
And the Young Ladies Illustrated Primer and the whole Victorian enclave that he created in that. So that was the first time that I, you know, even thought about, you know, the whole idea of the society of people that would deliberately put themselves back into Victorian times and dress up and play with paper. And I loved it because I'm obsessed with stationery and all sorts of, I knit and whatnot. Ideas that tend to be associated with a more traditional society that most people, you know, we've kind of turned that on its head with steampunk, though, where women can be strong and whatnot.
Yeah, so. Steampunk is odd that way because if you were going back in Victorian times, no woman would want to live in Victorian times.
No.
But in steampunk, you know, the women hitch their skirts up and they get themselves a great big ray gun.
Right.
So you kind of get the best of both worlds. You're wearing the corset and looking nice, but you're also mixing it up with the boys. So and it's also got that big maker culture in it, you know, the DIY ethic, you're making your own stuff. I mean, T and I went to the Steampunk World's Fair up in New Jersey a few months ago. And it was just fun. Incredible. Yeah, just seeing all the people who had made all this stuff. I mean, there were plenty of, there was a good amount of authors there, but like 80, 90% of the people were in costume and there were some amazing things that made themselves. And that kind of blew me away. And I can see why people like that because you don't get that in modern culture, really, you know, that you can make your own stuff and.
Because. Yeah, I mean, it's generally not, and the whole making, obviously, but then the whole, you know, you get to be traditional while still being completely, utterly modern.
Mm-hmm.
so many ways, you know, with obviously women's rights and everything like that.
Yeah.
It's been a fun genre to play with, and I actually have not read much in the way of steampunk novels. I've just followed kind of the steampunk culture.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think that it's more about the culture than it is necessarily the books, or do you think, have the books followed the culture?
I think at the moment there is a sort of an explosion of steampunk novels coming out at the moment.
Right.
And so I think it has been the fact that the movement sort of created the literary movement in its wake. And right. And people are enjoying that. I mean, I know T and I got people saying, "Oh yes, you wrote steampunk. You're jumping on that bandwagon." And I was like, "Yeah, well, you know how long it takes to write a book? it was a while ago.
It
wasn't a bandwagon. And in fact, T and I didn't set out to actually write a book because it was back in 2009. I said I wanted to do a podcast for pay. A lot of people were sort of fiddling around with the idea of getting podcasting to pay. And I thought, well, you know, I want to write something and try this, but I don't want to write a whole book. And that's why I got T to do the other half. He wrote Wellington Books' chapters, and I wrote Eliza Braun's chapters. And so it wasn't it, when the people say, "Oh, yeah, wrote a book to market," I was like, it was never supposed to be a book.
Right. You've just totally dashed our dreams.
Yeah, know. Sorry.
We're never going to get paid for this? Got it. I quit.
Oh, poor Jen.
My husband will be so disappointed to hear that.
I mean, you can make money out of podcasting, but I, as they say, don't quit your day job, but, you know.
Yeah. I don't have one. That's the problem.
Well, don't pick up podcasting as a day job. Although having said that, T's actual day job is he tweets and podcasts and does Facebook for a living. So they are out there.
What a bastard.
I know. It's incredible that there is a job out there like that. But yes.
Yeah, can you hook me up by any chance? I mean, that's what I do all day anyway. So
if you've read his blog, it took him 2 years to find it. So
get working, Jen. Get working.
I know, right? And I just started too. Oh, I'm screwed. Now, how long have you been podcasting?
5 years. Wow. Yeah, over 5 years now. January. Was it January or February 2006? So that would be about right. Yes. Yes. It feels like longer than it is.
How have you seen the interest in podcasts changing over the years?
That was what I was going to ask.
Well, I think when in the Heliconian early days of podcasting fiction, everybody thought that, okay, all I have to do is get a podcast my novel, and fame will just be attracted to me, and I will immediately kick through the doors of big publishing, and they will go, "We are not worthy," and throw contracts upon you. Having said that, I think podcasting helped me in the fact that it gave me an audience, and when I had my first contract, which was with Ace, I was able to say, "Well, I've got this many listeners." They weren't kicking down my door to find me, but when I found them, they were like, "Oh, okay, yeah. All right, come on. All right, we'll give you a try. Come on in. Don't put your feet up on the couch. We'll see
don't
if you
get comfortable. Right.
Yeah, don't get too comfortable. We'll check you out." So, yeah, I think reality has kind of filtered down. People are now realizing that podcasting isn't the be-all and end-all of a writing career, but it is a great part of a social media presence. And I still love podcasting. I'm still podcast. I mean, we haven't been able to podcast the Ministry of Peculiar Occurrences, and I haven't been able to podcast Geist. However, we did. We have been podcasting short stories set in the ministry world, and we've got people like Nathan Lowell and Phil Rossi and some other great names of people that actually hadn't even tried podcasting, and we're doing short stories set in that world, so sort of an anthology, and I'm doing the same with the Books of the Order as well. So yeah, I I think people are more realistic these days. And that's not a bad thing.
No, it's a good thing. I'm learning that. It's fun.
Yeah, I mean, this has definitely been a learning experience for us in a lot of ways. Are we getting sick of each other yet, Sean?
No, because the only reason I keep doing this is I have a blast doing it. If it became work, I would stop. That's the only reason I do it is because I get to talk to authors and I get to have fun.
Absolutely.
So. And it's our way to hang out with each other.
That's not a bad thing either, you know.
No, exactly.
I mean, podcasting has given people in their basements a way to talk to each other and interact and share things. I mean, I was in New Zealand. I mean, come on. I think when I started, there was no New Zealand podcasters, and now there are three. So
three whole podcasters in all of New Zealand.
Three whole podcasters. Oh, maybe it might be half a dozen. I don't know.
And that's like 30% of the population.
Yeah, yeah. We just don't want the sheep to start podcasting because then it's all over. But it made, for me, it was a great way of getting beyond my little niche. And I was quite, I mean, I don't want to play the smallest violin in the world, but I was quite isolated because there wasn't a huge science fiction writer, fantasy writer community around me. So I was able to go and find a community that was overseas. So that and that really buoyed me up as far as, you know, keeping me writing and stuff I might have given up otherwise.
Yeah, because it is. I mean, I can imagine in a time right before the internet that you would be really, really isolated. You'd have nobody to talk to, and it would cost immense amounts of money just to go anywhere.
Well, to send your manuscript anywhere. I mean, I remember when I first tried to get published, I had to print off all my pages. Then I had to go to the post office, find a huge box, and get these little green pieces of paper that were called international reply coupons. And you had to work out by some sort of voodoo how many international reply coupons it would cost to person to send you this manuscript back if they didn't want it. And it was awful. And of course nobody ever replied to you because I guess when they saw those little green coupons they were like, what are these? So, and actually that's why I did have a brief period where I gave up on writing, and that was pretty much because I said, well, no New Zealander has ever sold any books. I mean, okay, there was one but one fantasy writer in New Zealand at the time, and I was like, well, he's going to be a fluke. And I gave up for a while, and sort of I only came back when the internet was around and I could connect with fellow, you know, writers all over the world.
Yeah, that's really scary because, I mean, World SF, which I don't know if you would consider New Zealand as a part of World SF. I mean, maybe not, I guess, depending on – but it seems like – Well,
it's just the whole idea of, you know, a country in the world not being a part of World SF.
Well,
even
World
I know
SF
what
is...
the purpose is. I get okay. it. I just, the, sorry.
You get it. Like, stuff published outside of what is traditionally the publishing market that comes from people that are outside of those traditional markets. But it's interesting that I was going somewhere with this, I swear. Oh, that with World SF, you get all of, you know, we're getting more of these authors from places that we never would have got, almost entirely because we can get in contact with them because of the internet.
Mm-hmm. I mean, there's been an actual boom in New Zealand. You probably haven't noticed it, but there was an actual boom of New Zealand writers. I mean, there's at least five of us that have got New York contracts. I mean, I'm not sure if you've heard of Nalini Singh, who writes sort of paranormal romance. But she's on the New York Times bestseller, and she's doing very well for herself. Pretty much until like 3 months ago, unknown in New Zealand. You know, she was selling like gangbusters in America, but unknown in New Zealand. But there's been a sort of an upsurge of people, and in fact, there's a Science Fiction Writers Association in New Zealand now, which is I would have just killed to have that available when I was sort of starting out. So, yeah. And I mean, in Ministry of Peculiar Occurrences, one of the main characters is from New Zealand. And they didn't ever try and change her. They never said to her, can you make her Australian?
Oh,
or anything
that would
like
be infuriating.
Yeah, they probably knew that would go down really badly.
Sorry. great. I just, there's so, I mean, Hollywood just does it.
Oh, yeah.
Make them
yeah.
American. I mean, if it's an American, we're good. And you're like, why would it ever, what? That doesn't even make sense.
Yes, sorry. But you see, New Zealanders are coming over and taking American jobs because Anna Paquin is in True Blood and she does it.
Yeah.
So, and she's from New Zealand.
Is she really?
Yes.
I had no idea.
I thought, no, wait, she's not. It's her man that's from New Zealand, I thought.
No, he's from Britain. Oh. He's British. She's from New Zealand. She was actually in, I don't know if you've ever seen the movie The Piano.
Yeah, oh, that's right.
She was the little girl on the piano.
Yeah. Mm. And didn't
but she wasn't in the piano. She wasn't in The Piano. Yes, she did. Yeah, she won the best supporting actress, I think.
What happened to her? Sorry.
I don't know. Sorry. She's
not as good as she used to be.
I wish she grew up.
No, I mean, one of the most interesting things to me since, you know, getting involved with this podcast, I've been totally dragged into it, kicking and screaming by Sean here, is our engagement with authors because of social networking and whatnot. And the fact that we can engage has totally changed, you know, how I think about the publishing industry and I'm sure how other writers are thinking about it. And I'm not a writer myself, but, you know, especially with things like Google Plus now where you can have the hangouts and so many authors are popping on and going, hey, hang out with me. And we'll write for an hour. And you're like,
that's
really
great. Yeah. I mean, I use, when I was, on dire deadline, I was like, okay, I'm going to do a writing sprint for an hour. Who wants to join me? And people would, you know, come in and tell me what their word count was. But there's just so many great ways that you can sort of find community. And the for me, the podcasting community is sort of my base, my home base. And but hanging out on social media and stuff is great, especially when people say, I read your book and I just want to, you know, talk to you and see pictures of your cat.
Well, they definitely do that with John Scalzi. I mean,
yeah.
People are a little bit obsessed with his cat, I think.
Yeah. But I mean, he's probably obsessed with his cat a bit.
He's very obsessed with all of his animals.
But I mean, but that's personable. I mean, no one wants to see you on an author on Twitter just, and I have seen people do this, where they just, all they tweet is, buy my book, buy my book, buy my book.
Oh.
You are Sean's best friend right now.
Yeah. I mean, I go on and just, you know, say the stupidest things, but I mean, that's because I'm a person and I want to be a person on social media. I don't want to be just a person that's, you know, pitching and pimping and stuff all the time. I mean, I do a bit. I mean, I say I've got a new podcast episode or there was a new review of Phoenix Rising or whatever. I do throw those in there as well because that's part of my life as well because I'm a writer. But yeah, I also say I'm sitting here waiting for my car to get fixed or here's my cat on top of the refrigerator, you know, that sort of stuff. And people seem to hang in there for
me. Yeah. The way I think of social media is it's kind of, I mean, this is stuff I blogged about, which is just odd anyway, but is that it's like contributing to a conversation. And if you're not actually adding anything to it, then you're just being annoying.
Mm-hmm.
So like people, like you said, who pretty much every tweet they have is just, here's my book. Oh, and something you didn't know. Here's my book. You know, just like constantly talking about their stupid product or whatever it is.
Yeah. It actually has the reverse effect on you. You go, I'm not going to buy your book. Now,
I don't even click. Just like, I'm not even going to follow you.
How could your book possibly be interesting if you're one of the least interesting people online?
Yeah.
You know, that's...
And it's also, I mean, it's also a great resource for writers. I mean, if you're stuck for something, like I've asked all sorts of questions about, you know, rifles in Victorian England. I mean, there are people out there who love that sort of question. They like to be helpful. So, you know, they'll come and help you. And there are also people who, you know, I get tweets about people saying, so when's the next book coming out or things like that. So, you know, I'm happy to answer those sort of questions. So,
excellent.
Yeah. I'm a big fan of social media.
Me too.
But that obviously doesn't mean I won't block you if you're being... or I love the button where it's block and report spam. Block and report for spam. Yeah.
Yeah.
I've been blocked a couple times. It hurts.
Oh no.
I don't think I think she gets blocked because she gets in trouble.
Not because I'm spamming people. I just like to argue occasionally.
Oh, yes, yes. Eventually some people will just go, I'm not talking to you.
I'm not talking to you. I don't consider myself a troll. I actually only argue with people I consider trolls, so maybe that makes me
you
a troll
feed the trolls.
In this instance. I do, yeah. And then they get mad at me and they block me, so.
Well, you didn't need them anyway. Crazy.
No, exactly.
But Jen's problem, your problem isn't that you attack trolls. It's that you argue with people who don't want their ideas to be challenged. And the second you challenge them,
their heads explode. I argue with trolls because to me, those people, you know, but that's part and parcel of being on the internet to me is trolls are kind of a fact of life. You are going to get people who are literally just there to say, I'm right and you're wrong and that's the end of the world. And you know, somehow, and especially, you know, and luckily it hasn't happened very often, but in a community where it's not really part of the community, but you do have people, you will always have people who want to consider themselves above everybody else because they're part of this community and are well respected in the community and whatnot or whatever. And then you kind of go, yeah, well, you're kind of a douche and they get mad at you.
Well, that happens in real. I mean, the
that
internet
happens in real
is
life, right.
Yeah, it happens in real life. I mean, I think the internet is just an extension of what humans are, and some of them are douches.
Exactly, it does happen occasionally, but it has been very nice to find out that you know authors are people too.
Yes, you know.
I didn't know that before I started.
I know.
This podcast.
You thought
I
we
had
were
no idea. I thought you were monkeys at typewriters.
Well, some of us are.
Oh, okay.
Like Shakespeare, for instance.
Yes,
obviously.
Oh, he's a total 100 monkey.
All right, so why don't we wrap this up? I hate to do it, but we are going long for us. And why don't you tell us what you're working on right now and what we can expect from you in the next few months, etc.
Well, let me see. I've finished Raid, so that's off. That should be out next year sometime, probably around summer, I would guess. I'm also editing with T our second book of the Ministry of Peculiar Occurrences, which will also be out sometime, probably summer next year. And after that, when I take a breath, I'm going to be editing a third series that I just signed a contract for with Pyre Books, which is called Hunter and Fox. And that, yes, you guessed it, should be out in summer next year.
Wow, that's going to be a fun season
for
you.
Yeah, summer, yeah.
So the New Zealand invasion led by Philippa Ballantyne.
Yeah, I am working on getting my own shelf in the bookshops. If there are any bookshops left, I'd like a shelf.
Yeah.
I've got to hurry.
You do.
Oh, they're all gone.
That's so horrible.
Yes, it is very sad. But e-books, yes. You can have an e-shelf of Ballantyne.
Well, that'll be something anyway.
Yeah.
Cool.
Otherwise,
so
we will bemoan the loss of bookstores with you.
Yes.
So you've got like 12,000 books coming out next year.
Yes, three. Oh, I had three this year, and then there'll be three next year. So watch me, my head implode. Yes. And then in 2013, there will be at least two. So the Mayans better be wrong.
Oh, I know. Yeah.
Otherwise, you'll never find out what happens to Raid and Saoirse and Merrick.
I think the world's supposed to end on my daughter's birthday, so I'm hoping it's not her fault.
I'm sure not. I think the Mayans just ran out of wall space.
Oh, probably. Bookshelves, but not. So anyway, thank you very much for coming on the show. Are we not done?
No. Where can people find you?
Oh, yes.
Oh, yeah. Where can people find you?
Well, I have numerous websites and I'm all over the place, but you can find my podcasts at podiobooks.com. You can find all my other stuff with websites, and I'm like a spider sitting in the middle of the internet, at pjballantyne.com.
Fantastic.
And they can get links through there to the short stories that you're doing and everything as well?
Links galore to the Ministry of Peculiar Occurrences website, which is actually ministryofpeculiarocurrences.com, and booksoftheorder.com, which will take you through to the Geist and the Spectre and the Wraith. Goodness.
Fantastic.
It's fantastic. All right. Well, thank you so much for being on the show. It was really great to have you.
It's been a hootenanny.
That's a new one.
I just thought I'd whip that out.
It's fantastic. So you guys could go check out her book, her books, actually, plural, her many books. Go check out her website and let her know how much you love her work.
Yes, please.
She would love it. So if you guys want to get in contact with us, you can do that in four ways. You can send us an email.
SkiffyandFanty@gmail.com.
You can leave a comment on the blog.
SkiffyandFanty.wordpress.com.
Send us an at message at Twitter.
SkiffyandFanty.
Or you can search Skiffy and Fanty on Google+, and supposedly that brings us up.
There's no and.
Oh, there's no and? It's just Skiffy Fanty.
We're just Skiffy Fanty, yes.
Which
our last name is
dirty.
Fanty. How does that sound dirty?
It just does.
Oh, regardless. That's where you can find us. And have a lovely week.
Bye.
Bye.
Hey, y'all, just real quick. So before we get into the Adventures in Sci-Fi Publishing ad, we were incorrect. We had to change the name for our Google Plus account. It is now Shawnee Jen, Shaunyjen. So if you want to look for us on Google Plus, you just have to do that. Just search Shawnee Jen. So hope to see you there. Hope you see you entering the discussion. All right, here is the ad.
Caution. You have entered the Podstruction Zone. Please secure all podcatchers. Caution.
How's it coming, guys? You
have entered. This won't go any faster if you keep interrupting.
Got it. Here's some steampunk, diesel punk, gothic punk.
Goth punk?
Gothic. Trust me on this.
Hey, you're the one who invited him to the show, Sean. I've got epic fantasy, sword and sorcery, and all the news on ebooks.
That's it. Check it out. Clock punk. Ooh, shiny.
I have space opera, time travel, Stargate, and...
Sean, is that He-Man?
Shut up. Boys, I think we did it.
A superior podcast.
Publishing, writing, genre, best-selling authors, and the hot new writers of today.
Editors and agents, contests? Did we leave anything out?
AdventuresInSciFiPublishing.com.
Subscribe today. Adventures in Sci-Fi Publishing, your podcast for science fiction and fantasy literature since 2006.
John?
It's just so beautiful.
Podstruction complete. Enjoy.
Our new intro music is Time Flux by Revolution Void. You can check them out at freemusicarchive.org.
Another weak human afraid to face death.
I fart in your general direction.
France, different planet.
The Force will be with you. Always.
End of line.